This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host today, Laura Goldberg. You might know me from my website, vittlesvamp.com, but I'm here today on the Food Channel at New Books Network, and I am so happy to have with me Grace Lin. She has a new book out. It's called Chinese Menu, The History, Myths, and Legends Behind Your Favorite Foods. Welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here, Grace.
Thanks, Laura. I'm so happy to be here.
I need to ask you first and foremost, in the beginning of your book, you say that you don't fabricate any of the stories, because in many ways, what you've done is taken the American Chinese menu that we know and love and told stories about all of the dishes that we see there. But you do say that even though you didn't fabricate these stories, you did embellish some of them. So I'm just curious, why myths and legends and not just straight up history?
Well, there's many different reasons, but one of the reasons is because when I started researching this this book and all the different things, such as like Kung Pao chicken, right? There are so many different stories about the legend of Kung Pao chicken that I wasn't really quite sure which ones were correct, you know? And so, and honestly, they were so old and so word of mouth and so... So much just legends that seemed like the right way to tell the stories. And honestly, I'm a storyteller myself. Most people know me as a children's book author and illustrator, and it's really folk tales and stories and fairy tales that really get me excited. So it's a mixture of those two things, probably more the latter than the former, but the former is a good excuse.
Whatever excuse you have, it's a fun read. And I'm going to say, this is going to be a little weird, but I used to work on a soap opera. And one of the stories you talk about is Emperor Zhu and his companion, Daji. And my gosh, they sound like the ultimate soap opera villains.
Yes, there are many, many stories about this couple. In fact, Daji is so renownedly known even to this day that people believe that she's not human. she was such a horrible, horrible person. They can't believe that she's human, that they still tell stories about her being this evil fox spirit that had taken over a human body.
Okay, well, what does the fox say? I'm not going to sing. Nobody wants to hear
that. But, poor fox.
I'm going to take a step back in terms of your own background, because I understand, am I correct? You grew up in Taiwan.
No, my parents grew up in Taiwan.
Okay.
I grew up in upstate New York.
Okay.
So I'm very, very much Asian American.
Okay. So, but you are really steeped in Chinese food through an American lens in this book, which I found really interesting. Like, just one dish alone, to me, sort of, you know, surmises it. Crab ragoon. I mean, it's a complete American invention. I mean, you mentioned other cultures that have become embedded in American cuisine, but I found it interesting that there was a wrestling at the end of the book, whether it was American Chinese food or Chinese American food. And I was hoping you can get into that a bit.
Sure. So, you know, all my life I've called it Chinese American food, but it was writing this book that my copy editor corrected me and said, it's actually American Chinese food. Now, before I explain the difference between the two, I guess it's really important for me to explain, like, the food that we eat at the Chinese restaurants here in the United States is very different than the food that you would eat in China or Taiwan or Hong Kong even. So for a long time, American Chinese food or Chinese American food, we've kind of looked down on it. In fact, I'm going to backpedal here a little bit and tell you a little bit about the inspiration of this book. The big inspiration for this book actually came for when I finished doing a picture book, a book for kindergartners, first graders, called Fortune Cookie Fortunes. And in that book, I did research on the fortune cookie, and I discovered that the fortune cookie is a completely American invention. So if you go to China, nobody knows what a fortune cookie is, right? And so when I told this to my friends at the time, this book was, I made it in like 2003, 2004. All of my friends would respond, "Oh, so the fortune cookie's not even really Chinese." And they always kind of said this in a tone of disgust and disdain. And that made me feel really bad for the fortune cookie, because, as I said, I'm Asian American. And I was like, wow, the fortune cookie is actually the very first, might be the very first Asian American food. And that's not something we should look down at because it's not completely Asian. That's actually what inspired me to do this book, Chinese Menu, because the same thing could be said about all the food that we eat here, the Chinese food that we eat here in the United States. It's not exactly the same that you eat in China or Taiwan. It's not really Chinese. But that doesn't mean that it's bad. I mean, I think that's where I'm trying to change it, kind of change that snobbery a little bit. It just means that it's different. And this book, I'm trying to give a little bit more respect to this Asian American cuisine, with the hope that, you know, it trickles down and it gives more respect to Asian Americans as well. So back to your question. Sorry, that was a tangent there.
More than a tangent. It was a terrific story, and I'm really glad you told it. But please continue.
So in the book, I label the food, the Chinese food we eat here in the United States, as American Chinese. Before I wrote this book, I called it Chinese American. But my copy editor said, No, it's American Chinese, because it's Chinese food that has been influenced by American tastes. And she said, if it was Chinese American food, then it would be American food influenced by Chinese taste. For example, if it was Chinese American food, it would be like a hamburger with Asian spices, you know.
Yeah.
so that would be Chinese American food. When we take French fries and we add you know, Chinese spices and I don't know, things that we would, ginger or something like that. I'm trying to think of things that are like stereotypically Chinese.
Sauce. Yeah.
Yes. and put it in duck sauce or something like that. That would be Chinese American food. But American Chinese food is dishes that were originally from China that have been altered for American tastes. And that's what we have here in this book and here in the United States.
And I will say, though, there are so many cultures where this has happened. I mean, it's not unusual for, you know, immigrants to come to the United States, bring their food, and then when they're trying to share it with others, to have to adjust it to either what the ingredients are here, wherever it is that they have their kitchen, or just different tastes. I mean, when you look at Italian American cuisine, which I guess now I should call American Italian cuisine, it is different than what you find in Italy, for example. There are plenty of dishes that you might find in what Americans would consider a French restaurant that you would just never see in France. So yeah, it's not too dissimilar from other cultures, but you're right. There is sort of a snobbery about American Chinese food and thinking it isn't real and it isn't good, especially among foodies, which is a shame, because to me, anybody who calls themselves a foodie should be embracing great food, no matter the form. As long as there's respect in the food and careful attention to how it's prepared and frankly, love put in the dish. I know that sounds maybe a bit much, but here I am being a bit much. And, you know, I grew up on American Chinese food. I remember, you know, having my parents picking up fried rice and beef and broccoli for dinner. And that was, you know, a huge treat, not to mention the glory that was the egg roll. So
yeah, and it was delicious, right? We enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I that said, I would like to get to some of your stories, because those were things I had never been introduced to before. Some of the myths and the legends regarding some of these dishes, because a lot of them actually do have roots in China.
Yes, definitely.
That they've been altered in some way for American tastes or American kitchens or American what have you. So I wanted to ask you about tea, because I've actually been to China and I was gobsmacked when I went to some of the tea malls and how important tea is part of the culture. But there was one story you told that was about white hair silver needle tea, where this woman, and well, frankly, this entire family is being told at different times, do not turn around for any reason until you have the plant. And that alone really echoed something from the Bible for me, where Lot's wife, you know, this disobedient woman, is turned into a pillar of salt after seeing the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And I couldn't help but make that connection. I do wonder whether or not there are any connections between the Bible and some of these myths, or it's just a question of these are the kinds of stories that are told time and time again.
Oh, that is a good question. Unfortunately, I'm not as familiar with the Bible as probably I should be. But
I'm not either. I'm a Hebrew school dropout. I'm going to admit that to the world. But it made me think about what are the themes, you know, Grimm's fairy tales. There are certain themes that we as humans revisit over and over again in myth. In Star Wars.
Yes.
You know, I was just curious, what are some of your favorite stories, and what are some of the trends that you see popping up over and over again in terms of themes and messages?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, as a writer, we often talk amongst ourselves about how there's really only two plots in the world, you know, hero goes on a journey and stranger comes to town, right? And so, but then if you go even further and you know, there's the hero's journey that's been kind of thought to death, and analyzed to death too. It's often this idea of someone having to leave the comfort of their home to for some better good, and to come back and bring back the elixir, right? And that's really completely in that story. It's so perfectly like the hero's journey in white hair, silver needle tea, like these this woman has to leave the comfort of her home to save all the people of the village, and she has to conquer the monster at the end, on the top of the mountain, to get the elixir of life and then bring it back to save everyone. I mean, I think that's a common trope in lots and lots and lots of stories all over the world, maybe because it's some things that people actually really did have to do at one point.
Well, also it makes for great Disney films.
Yes.
I mean, I will say I was reading a lot of these and I immediately saw films. I immediately, you know, these sprung to life. I mean, what are some of your favorite stories, if you don't mind telling
them now? That my favorite stories are not as much of a hero's journey as the White Heron Silver Needles tea story, but one of my favorite stories is the story of spring rolls. And so everybody has had a spring roll or an egg roll, and everybody kind of agrees that the egg roll is an offshoot of the spring roll. We call spring rolls because they were originally eaten only during the spring festival, the Chinese Spring Festival. But the name of the spring roll actually does not have anything to do with the origin story. The origin story has to do with this Ming Dynasty minister who would get his work done twice as fast as all the other ministers around him. And in fact, he got his work done so quickly that the other ministers became quite jealous, and they felt like he must be cheating, that somehow he must be having somebody else do his work for him. And they were so jealous and so suspicious that they brought those suspicions to the emperor. Now, the emperor noticed that this minister also got his work done quite quickly. So he called this minister to him and said, "How do you get your work done so quickly?" And the minister then had to reveal his big secret. And his big secret was that he could write with two hands. He said, "Because I can write with two hands," he said, "I can get my work done twice as quickly." Now, of course, no one believed that he could write with two hands. So the emperor said, "All right, here's 9 boxes of records. Copy them all in 9 days. And if you can really write with two hands, it should be no problem." So this minister brought these records home. But when he opened the boxes, he realized there were so many records in these boxes that he would have to work night and day without stopping, even with using both of his hands. So that's what he did. He started night and day, not stopping to eat, not stopping to sleep, and was just copying and copying these records with his two hands going all the time. Now, this minister had a wife who was quite worried about him. And when she saw that he wasn't stopping to sleep or eat, she said, "Oh, but you have to at least eat." And he says, no, "I can't stop. My hands must keep moving or else I won't finish." And she's like, "Well, then I'll feed you." And so she tried to feed him things like soup and noodles. But of course, those are too messy. And he's like, no, I cannot eat them because I need my two hands. And so she went into the kitchen and she thought, "Okay, I need to make a food that he can eat without using his hands." So she invented a rolled food that she could hold and he could bite off as his two hands are writing. And of course, that rolled food was the spring roll, the food that we now still eat today.
I can see why you are a very successful children's book writer. I would have loved you at story time with Mrs. Flugger at my library. But, there are so many stories in here, though. I mean, one of them that I was really surprised about was the one about wonton soup and the Taoist creation story. Who knew that there was that much going on in my bowl of wonton soup?
Yes, that's a beautiful story. Did you want me to share that one?
Yes, please.
Okay, so wonton, we call wonton soup because most of the people who came here, the early immigrants from China, were from Canton. So they spoke Cantonese. And so they called wonton soup wonton. And so that's why we call it wonton. Now, wonton is a lovely word that if you can kind of translate into swallowing clouds, which is really a lovely way to think about your soup, because like the wontons are kind of like these clouds that you swallow. But if you look at the etymology of the word, like the actual characters, you'll notice that it's also referencing something called the primordial chaos. And what that's referencing is the Taoist creationist story. Now, the Taoist creationist story begins with the primordial chaos. So to the Taoists, before there was a world, before there was a universe, before there's anything, there was just the primordial chaos. It was just this kind of thin, thick, kind of this cloudy soup everywhere. And that's what the soup in your wonton soup represents, the primordial chaos. And they said, but over time in this soup, a round white thing started to congeal inside of it. And that's what your dumpling is. Your dumpling symbolizes this white congealing in the primordial chaos. Now, the story continues. Now, this white congealing actually was an egg. And inside this egg was a giant who was growing bigger and bigger and bigger. And one day, the giant grew so large that he cracked open the egg and he held the top of the egg above him and he pushed the bottom of the eggs below him with his feet. And he kept growing taller and taller and he kept pushing the top of the egg higher and higher and higher. And he kept pushing the bottom of the egg lower and lower and lower and then he kept doing this for like 30,000 years until finally, after he had pushed the top of the egg and the bottom of the egg so far apart that they could never, ever join again, he fell over and he died. And so the top of the egg became the heavens and the bottom of the egg became the earth and the world that we know now. And everything living on this world is what is left over from that giant who pushed these two parts of the egg apart. So his breath became the wind and the clouds. His sweat became the rain. One of his eyes became the sun. The other eye became the moon. His body turned into mountains and his blood became the oceans and the river. And his hair became the trees. And the thing that really gives me the heebie-jeebies is that they say that the fleas and the lice that lived in his hair became the animals of the earth.
Oh, gosh.
But all of this is in your wonton soup. So when you eat wonton soup, the soup is the primordial chaos. Your dumpling is that egg that the giant was in. And when you break that wonton, that dumpling open, you are just like that giant creating the heaven and the earth.
When I started reading that story, vermin aside, I've got to say, it just made me think this is exactly how you're going to get some small child to eat wonton soup that wouldn't before if they're thinking, I'm a giant.
Yes.
Something so delightful about it. And mm-hmm. I'm going to have a hard time eating wonton soup without like puffing out my chest and thinking to myself that I'm a giant, you know, creating the world. It's quite a lot for a little bowl of soup.
Yes. But it's wonderful too.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. And I mean, I also want to talk to you a bit about how you set up the book, because the way you set it up was the way that we look at a menu. But you also explain, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of the ways that we categorize Chinese food, or in this case, American Chinese food, it isn't how they would eat in China. For example, appetizers. Yes. You're saying that, you know, yeah, we put some stuff together that are appetizers on this menu, but for example, dumplings are really only a dish for holidays. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that and how you set up this book and why it works despite the challenges with what you would see on a table in China.
Yeah, so traditional Chinese dining is really, really different than how we eat, how we expected to eat here in the United States. You know, like you said, we expected an appetizer, a side dish, a main dish, you know, dessert. That's not really how they ate traditionally in China. In China, it was like they brought out the rice and you had a couple of side dishes. Like what's really interesting to a lot of people is like, you know, what we consider the side dish, you know, the noodles, the rice, that was considered the main dish in traditional Chinese cuisine, right? And all the things that we consider main dishes, like the beef and broccoli, like the, you know, the mapo tofu, like those were always in very small amounts, and those were considered the side dishes that you ate with the rice. We've completely reversed that. So whereas like the beef and broccoli is the main thing when you and you put a little rice with it. It's all of these things that immigrant Chinese restaurateurs had to kind of adapt to. And that's why it's American Chinese food. They realized that Westerners wanted to eat in a certain way. And so they adapted their cuisine to fit it. So like you said, dumplings are usually for the Lunar New Year, but they said, okay, we'll have that as an appetizer. Same with the spring roll. Like I said, usually we ate those at the spring festival, but they said, okay, we'll use that as an appetizer. Or a side dish, and all of these things. Even the idea of soup and tea, right? So tea was very, very, and continues to be very, very important in Chinese cuisine. But originally, they did not have beverages with traditional Chinese dinners. They would always have soup. Like soup was your liquid that you would eat with.
There was a line in your book that was, you can eat without meat, but you cannot eat without soup.
Yes. Soup is so important. That. And that's why soup was the beverage, and tea you actually had separately, you know. So, and same with the dessert, you know. So it was a lot of adaptation that Chinese immigrants had to do. And that's why in the book I often say, you know, this food that sometimes we disdain, we should not disdain, because it really is actually the flavor of America. You know, like it's the flavor of triumph, it's the flavor of adaptation, it's the flavor of these immigrants figuring out how to survive and thrive here in the United States, which is so American. And so I feel like all of this is really like all of American Chinese food is the flavor of America.
Well, you tell a story in the book that's not a story at all, it's history, about chop suey, how that came to be. And there's a lot of sadness in there, and then a lot of triumph as well. Would you mind talking about that?
Chop suey is one of those dishes that has had a huge rise and fall here in the United States. And it's also one of those dishes that a lot of people like to poo-poo. It's not really Chinese food. It's really a hard thing. It's very likely that there was a dish that chop suey came from that originally had animal entrails in it. And of course, here in the United States, we don't like to eat entrails. So it's likely that, you know, a Chinese immigrant took the entrails out and said, here's chop suey or sap suey. But the myth or the legend of chop suey, it also sounds so so realistic. It seems like it could be true. So I'm not sure which way it is, but the legend is, like I said, rings so true. So the legend of chop suey begins with, of course, Chinese immigrants who came here to the United States during the gold rush. Of course, they came just like so many other immigrants looking for gold, you know, with the dream of Gold Mountain. But once they got to California and got to Gold Mountain, there was no more gold. There was no more gold for them. And most of the Chinese immigrants were so poor, they didn't even have enough money to go back to China. So they had to scrape out a living in the gold fields where there was no gold. And so what many of them did was open restaurants. And this actually ties into, I'm taking a small tangent, sorry. This ties into a little bit of why perhaps we don't respect Chinese food as much as we should, because even though Chinese food is quite difficult to make, it's just as complicated as French food, but we consider it cheap food. We consider Chinese food cheap food, probably all because all the way back then and during the gold rush, these Chinese immigrants had to price their food very, very inexpensively, very, very cheaply in order to get people to try it and to eat it. So that's what they did. They priced their food very, very cheaply to get people to to buy it and eat it. And they were very successful, and that's how they were able to survive. Now, the story of chop suey continues, where, you know, because they were Chinese immigrants, they were often targets for violence and racism. So a lot of Chinese immigrants had to be very careful. And one night, after a Chinese restaurateur had closed up his restaurant, a group of drunk European miners came in demanding food. They were hungry, they were drunk, they were rough. And the Chinese restaurateur knew better than to say no to a group of drunk, angry miners. And so he said, yes, yes, come in, I'll feed you. But then when he went to his kitchen, he realized that he had no food, that the food delivery was coming the next day, and he had nothing to serve these drunk miners. And these miners were getting angrier and angrier, and the Chinese chef was desperate. And so he looked at his scrap barrel, mainly his garbage barrel, and he dumped it into a pan, stir-fried it, covered it with a sauce, and served that to the drunk miners. And the drunk miners loved it. And they asked him what it was called. And the chef, knowing that they did not know any of his Chinese dialect, said, oh, it's chop suey, which in his Chinese dialect, of course, which of course meant odd scraps, but they didn't know that. And so they're like, oh, sure, chop suey.
I thought it was the most elegant dish they'd ever had.
Yes, ever had. Dish.
Yeah, they didn't realize it was just scraped out of the
garbage
trash.
Yeah. And so that is the legend of chop suey. Like I said, that's probably not true, but it sure has a lot of truth in it, I think.
Well, reading about that, you also talk about how there was anti-Chinese sentiment that really grew during that period of time. And there were, in 1882, there was the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yes.
Which was, I believe, the first and only government legislation to actually exclude immigrants solely because of race. And
yes,
the idea that it passed is just horrifying.
Yes.
And it made it almost impossible for Chinese to immigrate here.
Yes.
If I'm not incorrect. And you go on to talk about how one of the very few loopholes was that you could be a special merchant.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a visa, and that special kind of visa would allow you to be a restaurateur.
Yes. So that's why there were so many Chinese restaurants and Chinese laundries, honestly, because those were the few loopholes in this Exclusion Act that Chinese could get a visa for, having a restaurant or having a laundry.
And do you think the people in China who are emigrating here to the United States knew that this was what they were going to have to do in order to earn a living? And then they said, you know, I want the U.S. badly enough.
I think most of them knew. The ones that opened the restaurants knew. I mean, basically, there were some big Chinese investors who opened big restaurants, and then they would get immigrants to come. So I think most of them knew, but I think they knew they were coming to the United States to work in a restaurant. They knew they were coming to the United States to work, but I think most of them, I mean, who know, all immigrants, nobody knows what you're in for, right?
True.
Nobody knows how hard it's going to be.
And
nobody
hard.
Knows what you're going to face, like how much discrimination or racism you're going to face until you get there.
And there's so much of it today. So I think your book, celebrating American Chinese food and embracing its history and its myths and its legends, as the name of your book says, I think brings a joy to exploring immigration and different communities in the U.S. in a way that I don't think we've been allowed to do as much as we should.
Yeah, I really hope it does that. What I really hope it does is, it celebrates the for lack of better word, the hyphen, right? Like, we actually don't use the hyphen anymore, but for a long time, it was like Asian hyphen American, Chinese hyphen American, you know, like, and I hope that this book really celebrates that the mix of Asian and American and shows that it's actually something quite wonderful.
I adore that celebrating the hyphen. I've not heard that. Is that something you just made up on the fly now, or is that something that I should be familiar with?
It's something that I've thought of for a long, long time, but it doesn't really work anymore because the correct way of saying Asian American is without the hyphen now. But for a long time, it was with the hyphen. And I often thought about that hyphen as being a bridge between the two, as being a connector, not as a divider. For a long time, I used to look at that hyphen and thought it was like a negative, like it was a minus sign. And it took me a long time to realize, no, it's not a not minus sign. It's a bridge. But like I said, we don't really use the hyphen anymore. So it's lost all its symbolism.
I'm old enough to remember the hyphen, and yeah. So I appreciate it. But you speak of bridges, and there's a connection that is often mentioned when we mention Chinese food, and that's the bridge between Italy and China in Marco Polo. And I know in the book you talk both about scallion pancakes and noodles. And I was hoping you could share a little bit about that and take some of the mystery out of that connection and that bridge.
Sure. So there's lots and lots of incorrect and stories about Marco Polo bringing food from China to Italy. So like a lot of people say, oh, Marco Polo brought noodles, and that's how spaghetti was invented. That is not true, though it is likely that noodles was invented before spaghetti or Italian pasta, but historians pretty much think that they were invented separately, like without influence or the other, because they were invented in Italy way before Marco Polo came over. Same with pizza, the scallion pancake. The story that I put in my book about scallion pancakes is the story, is the myth, the legend, the one that I was told when I was a kid and I really believed it. But upon doing this book, I have found out is not true, is how Marco Polo loved scallion pancakes so much that when he returned to Italy, he really, really wanted to eat scallion pancakes again, but he had only eaten them in China and he did not know how it was made. He never made them. And so he told all these cooks and chefs about the scallion pancake, and they all attempted to make it for him, but they didn't understand how, like, the scallions were in the dough and all those things. And so eventually none of his chefs were ever able to make the scallion pancake, but one of his chefs did make the pizza, which I always, like I said, I always believed as a child, but it was not a true story. But the one that is possibly true, is ice cream or gelato. This one actually is possible because the ancient Chinese figured out how to freeze ice in warm weather way before any other civilization that we know of. They actually had icemen, people called icemen, right, who would make ice. Of course, it was quite difficult and it was quite valuable. So they made ice for a long time, but they never made ice cream or ice milk until the Mongol Empire came over. Until the Mongols took over China. And the Mongols drank a lot of milk in their diet. The Han Chinese did not, which is why they never froze milk before. But Kublai Khan, as people probably recognize that name, did drink a lot of milk, and he was very upset when he ruled China that his milk would spoil. And so the Chinese servants adapted their ice making machine to make ice milk. And Kublai Khan was the one who was in power when Marco Polo came to visit China. And it's very likely that Kublai Khan treated Marco Polo to ice milk because that was considered a very, very special treat that Kublai Khan would give his guests. And it's very likely that Marco Polo took this memory of ice milk to Italy, and slowly it became gelato and ice cream, which we know today.
And now all I want is some gelato with a fortune cookie. That would be just perfect.
That would be perfect. Treat. Yes.
Perfect midday treat. Speaking of treats, though, what is your go-to order when you walk into an American Chinese restaurant?
When I go to American Chinese restaurant, the things that I always order is depends on who I'm with too. But if I'm just by myself, I always get the dumplings, because the dumplings are almost always good. Very few places can mess up dumplings, right? So I always get the fried dumplings. I usually get either the mushu pork, or because that's, I love mushu pork, like the wrapping, or I get the kung pao chicken. But if I'm with my family, we always get the General Tso's chicken. And then usually after that, of course, and then some kind of noodles usually.
Well, I've got to say, I'm with you on the dumplings, but I'm always surprised when I order fried dumplings. They're supposed to be pan fried, and every once in a while they're deep fried. And that always throws me off.
Yes.
Throws me off. But one of my favorite dishes, and actually I will fully admit, I usually cook for Thanksgiving, but I met up with my mother and I took her out for American Chinese food, and we had Peking duck, which is one of my favorites. And I mean, it's so complicated. I mean, you talk about how it's made in the book.
Yes.
I'm just not doing it.
It's worth it. Because I eat Chinese food fairly regularly, so you can't really get Peking duck every time. That's like a special occasion thing.
But, oh, yeah.
But that's definitely one of that. It might be my favorite. I'm trying to think if it's my favorite.
There's so many favorites. I mean, there are dishes. I go to Chinatown. I live in New York and I go to Chinatown regularly. And the food in Chinatown, a lot of it isn't American Chinese. It really is more classic Chinese. Like, I love snow pea leaves,
Yes.
Oh my God, so good. But there is something wonderful about, Kung Pao chicken, as you said, or lo mein, or, these dishes that are really comfort, for me, having grown up with them. And American Chinese food is definitely something that most Americans, no matter what corner of this country they're from, that they recognize. So it's lovely that you're sort of opening people's eyes to where these dishes come from and the stories that have brought them to us.
Yes.
So I'm going to let you go, but I just want to say to everyone listening, if you like Chinese food, if you like American Chinese food, if you have someone on your list for the holidays who enjoys a good egg roll, Chinese Menu, The History, Myths, and Legends Behind Your Favorite Foods by Grace Lin. Thank you so much for being here, Grace. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Laura. It was really great being here. Thanks so much.